Okay, Safratabba. Good morning, everybody. If you're at the far ends of the library, smoking in the boys' room, come on back to us.
Shut up and sit down?
Nah, shut up. I've been teaching high school way too long to back in the day. If you don't remember me, I do not begrudge you. I'm Rabbi Mark Asher Goodman. I think Danny probably filled you in, but I'm taking over. So on this history unit, I was your sometime sub last year, and I'm your middle relief pitcher. I don't know why I'm thinking about baseball so much today. But anyways, so I'm really glad to be here. Someone asked me on Monday, said, Rabbi, you seem to be filling in a lot of different areas of Judaism. What makes you, whereas Danielle Kranchak was a, I think she had has her master's degree in history with a focus on medievalism, and we've just come to kind of the post-medieval period. The question kind of was thrown at me like, Rabbi, what credentials do you have to teach history? We have to learn history in rabbinical school. Clearly, it's not a focus of mine. I also was a poli-sci major undergraduate. You have to do a ton of that when you're in school. And then when I taught at the day school in Denver, Colorado, I taught American Jewish history, and I taught at a kind of an 11th and 12th grade level, which is mostly graduate level and college level texts. And I taught Zionist history, which also kind of came with the same background. So if you're wondering, do I have the credentials? The answer is sort of. I feel pretty good about it. I'm like you. I'm an inveterate reader and like to be educated and know stuff. And usually I like to read Jewish stuff, and I like to travel around the world. And when I travel around the world, I go see the Jewish stuff in given places. So Eastern Europe, Spain, Italy, all these wonderful things. Okay, today we are in Crossroads, Chapter 17, Fighting for the Soul of Eastern Europe, Hasidim and Mitnagdim. That is what my book tells me. If I'm totally wrong on this, we can go backwards, but I think we're in the right spot. So flip open your books to 17, and if I get a volunteer to just read where we start, one of my small lacks is that I have the teacher's guide, because I started up midstream. I have the teacher's guide, but not the actual book that you guys use. And there's always a little bit of a discrepancy, and I don't know the difference. So flip open to Crossroads, chapter 17. Whoever finds it first, yell out the page number for everybody else. 203. If you don't have your name taggy thingy up today, please put it up so that I remember your name. It's been a year since I saw you last. So it would be helpful. Although Eric I knew because he picks up his kids all the time. So his grandkids. Grandkids, kids.
How dare you, sir.
Both.
Mike did.
Okay, volunteer to read like the first paragraph. Mimi, go ahead. Mimi, did I see you in the paper?
Yeah.
It was
not the crime round.
Yeah, not the crime round. So Mazel Tov on your appearance in the paper. Did everyone else see this?
And it wasn't about me. It was about the wonderful program of which I am so blessed to be a part, called J Film.
Mm-hmm.
A Jewish film festival. We work with the education branch called Teen Screen. And I don't know if you can, probably today is the last day you can get that issue. The city paper changes every week.
Yeah.
But if you get Public Source, we're also on Public Source, and it was a really well-written article about what we do and how we do it, and we're all volunteers.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, I like City Paper. I think the quality of City Paper is very, very good.
Yeah.
Very. And I grew up in Los Angeles, and we had a City Paper, and it got bought out and went downhill. But
it's
Pittsburgh's is very good. Oh, I like it better than the BG, but that's okay.
Well,
all right. No editorialism for me. All right.
I like
Mimi, our local celebrity, will begin by reading.
Yeah. The shortest one in the picture. historical background. Following the pogroms of 1648 and 1649, Jewish communities of Poland and Lithuania became more isolated from other groups within the society. Ever fearful of anti-Jewish violence, as noted by scholars of the Polish Jewish community, including S.M. Dubna. The Jewish communities were particularly obsessed with minimizing the chances such pogroms would occur again, a goal which focused on the idea that the Jews were responsible in some way for the violence enacted against them. In this vein, the Council of the Four Lands laid down very strict laws intended to protect the Jewish communities across Poland and Lithuania. The Kahal used its authority to exhort the community to obey its mandates, including being forbidden from accepting the stewardship of the landed gentry estate. It also prohibited Jews from entering into business partnerships with non-Jews without permission of the Kahal, as this could result in conflicts with Christians, which in turn would affect all the Jews. The express goal of all of these new laws was to avoid the Polish authorities, for their intervention would be nothing but disastrous for the community. These laws carried the additional benefit of consolidating all Jewish authority into a single body, and thus preventing...
Oh, you went too far.
Oh, sorry.
It's okay. So, just to summarize the historical background part, which goes on for a little bit, do you guys remember the last lesson you did before the layoff for the winter? Who was the last historical figure? Did you guys cover Shabtai Tzvi at all?
No.
Yes, no. Okay, roughly time-wise, did you guys remember what year you roughly left off on? Did you cover at all these massacres of 1648?
No.
No. Okay, so let's give... Right, I'm jumping in midstream. We're having fun here. All right, let's do a quick kind of rough review, really simplistic rough review of Jewish life in the Middle Ages. We're going to call the Middle Ages like 1300 to... For the Jews, it's really, theoretically, there is no Renaissance for the Jewish people, which is a topic we'll kind of cover later on. There's a golden age in the 1500s, but the Renaissance doesn't hit us because we don't really have the beautiful painting and all the philosophy and so on. So roughly in Judaism, there's this middle period which... you could really say goes from 1300 to 1848, and you could also argue that it's interrupted. These are good numbers to write down because it's a simplification of history, which I always find useful. There's two other dates that you might want to put in here that you probably already know from history, 1776 and 1792. All three of these dates are dates of an upcoming important time period that we'll cover, which is the emancipation. So before the emancipation is the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment has some impacts on Jews, and we will talk about those. But this rough period here is kind of, you could call it the Middle Ages. It's a huge amount of time. A lot of historians would say, no, that's not true. But roughly from 1300 to 1848, this is a time period for Jews which is basically, you could call it the Middle Ages, although that's somewhat inaccurate, and I'm copping to that. You can also just call this not great times, would be a better way of saying this.
The Age of Argument.
Yeah, that's a technical term. What's that?
What was the Haskalah?
Haskalah, that's Enlightenment. So that's the Jewish version of Enlightenment. Jewish version of Enlightenment doesn't start till Jews are allowed to go to universities. And Jews aren't allowed to go to universities until 1776 in the United States, 1792 in France, 1848 in Central Europe. So that's why, so you've nailed it. That's what those three dates are. But that's pretty late because the period of Enlightenment for people like Voltaire, people in the non-Jewish world, occurs earlier. It occurs in the 1600s, 1700s, when Enlightenment scholars could go to university. Jews were not permitted to go to European universities until these three dates. It's interesting that Jewish emancipation occurs in the United States before any other country in the world, with a few exceptions depending on how you got out there. But we're not there yet, so keep your pants on. Not great times. What do I mean by not great times? So the first thing that was mentioned was the pogroms of 1648, which are also known as the Chmelnytsky massacres. I'm going to try and demonstrate that I can spell the word Chmelnytsky.
Good job.
Chmelnytsky. So Bogdan Chmelnytsky was a, he is the George Washington of the Ukraine. He was a great patriot and a well-regarded man of his time. There are statues of him on horseback throughout the Ukraine because he united the Ukraine through kind of blood and iron, like a very typical nationalist. And how did he do that? He got a group of other men on horseback together who rode through the countryside and basically made all the little counties and fiefdoms pledge fealty to him as their national leader. He did that by riding through towns and burning down, raping and pillaging the villages that he went through and any people who were not on his side, specifically the Jews. Now, it's not that the Jews were against Khmelnytsky, but murdering Jews was just popular in Eastern Europe back in the day. That's why we have these things called pogroms. Pogroms were xenophobic, violent raids against the local Jewish community, which accomplished the goal of proving to the locals that you were a brave warrior and also truly believed in the Ukrainian cause. Nothing new. Basically, the Crusades are the same thing, right? They just happened 300 years earlier. So the Khmelnytsky massacres in 1648 are really bad, and they set off a wave of pogroms that in Europe basically continues roughly unabated into the early 1900s. They are alleviated for a brief period with kind of industrialization, and then, as you all know, or we will talk about, are kind of continued again with the Holocaust. I like that Jan left me literally one piece of paper. So we're going to be
writing on the back. Yeah, that was for my program Sunday. You're welcome to draw on the back of it, of the golem.
Oh, it was yours?
Yeah, it was from the one that was just there was from a program. You can draw on the back of it.
There's like also blank pages. I think the backs are shinier, though, but whatever. Anyways. Oh, no, there's all. Wait. No, I'm dumber than I look. There's a whole nother chart here.
Yay.
I'm not as dumb as I look. All right.
Oh, don't get excited.
Nope. I got excited and I'm wrong. These are all, are they all used? That one's used. Yeah, they're all used.
I mean, there's a lot of blank space on that paper, though.
Yeah, I'll use this one. It'll be fine. Just ignore this.
May I ask
Yeah, go. Question? Please. I love when you guys ask questions.
Just the word pogrom.
Yep.
Is that limited only to Jewish massacres?
Then, yes. Now, no. Today, it's a universally used term. There's a similar word that got reappropriated, which is the word ghetto. There used to be the Hebrew, the word ghetto originated because the neighborhood in Venice that the Jews were all forced to live in was the foundry, and the Italian word for foundry is ghetto. But today, as you all know, in America, the word ghetto is frequently used to refer to a lower income neighborhood that people are kind of either redlined into or forced to live into, and it does not have specific ethnic connotations. So language changes. That's all I can tell you. Anyhow, so pogroms. So I'm going to ask you guys to kind of figure this out. So let's say you're poor and you're Jewish and people ride through your village every once in a while on horseback and burn things down. And you are basically a landless serf or a relatively unskilled tradesperson. There is literal opportunity to move up in the world. What are your outlets for dealing with your situation? How do you mentally process being dealt a rough hand in life? And you can look at any kind of marginalized community around the world in history and see how do they kind of deal with getting the, for lack of a better word, crappy end of the stick?
Religion.
Good. So religion is one.
Close ranks.
We can also talk about what in or what philosophies within religion one would kind of call upon in order to get through life. So you said close ranks. Can you explain a little more?
Meaning that you move closer in with those like you, community, to avoid being singled out.
Good. community, solidarity, right? Very good. Anything else? Yeah.
Don't do anything to cause trouble.
All right. Keep your head down. Doesn't work super great, but they do that to a degree. One famous thing that occurs in the 1700s is you get these stories about Jews who would have disputes. And when you had a dispute, they could be internally resolved through community, but you were also permitted under the laws of your local potentate to either go to the local bishop or to go to the local city council and raise your disagreement. The problem with that was if you have a disagreement with your neighbor, there's a decent chance that the bishop will take all of your neighbor's property and just redistribute it to people on his own side as part of the legal decision, that you will get a bad legal decision for both of you. One other thing that would happen is, let's say robbery or a crime was committed, whereas the Jewish community might say you owe $1,000 plus a penalty of $500. The bishop might say, oh, you stole this money, the penalty is death, right? So now you've used the Christian courts to get a fellow Jew killed. There's a word for that in Hebrew that got used in the Jewish communities going back 500 years, and it's called a moser. And a moser is a rat. And according to Jewish law, you cannot be a moser on your fellow Jew in a Christian court because it might result in death. It's a principle that goes all the way back to the Talmud and was still going on in the time of the pogroms. Yeah.
So that what that means is then you create your own laws within
the Jewish community structure. Almost always, going all the way back to the Talmudic era and in the Babylonian era of the Talmudic period, had their own courts, their own laws, their own leadership structure. And usually they tried to deal with everything internally. But occasionally, things would spill outside of the bounds, and that was generally thought of as bad. So you've got religion. So what aspects of the Jewish religion could you call upon to kind of rationalize a life that is basically lived in misery and toil and was, to quote Thomas Hobbes, nasty, brutish, and short, which is basically what Jewish life looked like in the medieval era.
You weren't following the Torah.
Okay, so theology, right? Bad people, bad things happen to them.
Right. Vengeful gods.
The vengeful god. It's not big in the Middle Ages, and that's because even the most, it didn't smack with reality, right? The most pious, the most wonderful Jews in the community would also die a nasty, brutish, and short death. And so it didn't quite jibe. So what's the other way of dealing with that theologically?
God's will.
You say God's will.
Ignore it.
Okay. There's another one, yeah. There's two others.
Build in the afterlife.
That's one.
Make it the big goal.
Good. So a big thing we're going to see, and we're going to turn to the text in a second. A big thing in the Jewish world that comes up in this time period, in the medieval time period, and into the 1700s, which we're going to be talking about in a second, is the afterlife. This belief that if you are a good person in this life, you will reap the reward in the world to come. It's a principle that appears in the Talmud, but the Hasidim, which we're going to be looking at today, are going to spend a lot more time talking about it. Olam Haba, the world to come, is a much more important principle when Olam Hazeh, this world, is hot garbage on a stick, right? When your life is really lousy, it's nice to think that the next world that you go on to, you'll get the reward that you're due for all the good deeds you do. There's another way of dealing with it. It's very tangentially mentioned in Jewish texts. It's basically all the information about the Messiah in Judaism appears in a couple places in the Tanakh. I'm talking like three. And one section of the Talmud, Sanhedrin 99 to page 101. So we're talking like a quote in Ezekiel, a couple quotes in Isaiah, and two pages of the Talmud, which has something like 70,000 pages in it, right? That's the totality of messianism. But when life is lousy, you like to think that maybe a divine ruler will restore the Jewish, a divinely inspired, potentially, ruler will restore the Jewish people to greatness. So there's this thread of messianism that starts to occur in the 1600s. There are two famous messiahs. You guys didn't talk about this?
No.
You haven't heard about this. We're not even up to this week's class, but I feel like I got to fill you in. mostly because these are great stories. So Sabbateanism, I don't know if I'm spelling this at all right because I'm not really thinking, and Frankism. So they both occur around the same tide, mid-1600s, mid-1700s. Shabtai Tzvi was a guy in the mid-1600s who originated in kind of like Eastern Europe and Turkey, and he basically, as far as we can understand, Shabtai Tzvi was a guy who kind of spoke in tongues and spoke, he sounded like a street corner lunatic, you know, basically your standard to slightly mentally diagnose him. He seemed to be bipolar or schizophrenic in his demeanor, in the sense that he would stand on the corner and spout words, and he sounded like a guy who was either divinely inspired or off his meds. They didn't have meds back then, which would imply that he was nothing special. There were probably lots of people like this, except he had the greatest PR man of all time, a guy by the name of the prophet Nathan. And Nathan met this guy, Shabtai Tzvi, and loved what he said. And Nathan took his words and spun them. And he said, what Tzvi said in this speech is so profound and amazing, direct from the mouth of God to Shabtai Tzvi, we've learned this great wisdom about the new evolution of Judaism that has come into our era. And so these two guys would tag team and barnstorm around Europe, and he would roll into town and he would give a lecture or a prophecy. And Tzvi would talk and Nathan would interpret. And the people truly began to believe that this person was touched by the hand of God and was divinely inspired. And so leaflets went from community to community. More and more people showed up at his talks. And literally tens of thousands of people were standing and listening to Shabtai Tzvi give words. And it would overwhelmingly sound like gibberish to you or I, like raw prophecy, or what you would see on the label of a Dr. Bronner's soap container. If you have not read a Dr. Bronner's soap container, I recommend it to you. And Nathan would spin it. So I'll give you one example, which is an extreme example, about how off the rails Tzvi was. There's a blessing we say in the morning. There are 13 blessings we say in the morning. The blessings are for getting up in the morning. And one of the blessings is, blessed are you, Lord our God, ruler of the universe, who frees the bound. Matir Asurim. Who frees the bound, right? It's a blessing for, thank God, who takes Jewish captives out of captivity, kidnapped victims. Matir can also mean in Hebrew to permit, and asur in Hebrew also means forbidden. So matir asurim was interpreted by Tzvi as meaning, thank you, Lord our God, ruler of the universe, for permitting the forbidden. And Tzvi said, God came to me in a vision and said, for my religion, that means that all of the laws of the Talmud that are direct, or of Judaism that are directly impermitted, are now permitted to me. Which means I now eat pork, and I now can sleep with your wife. And it is not a violation to me in any way, shape, or form. Right? This was the kind of prophecy that Tzvi was bringing, and the Jews were into it, partially because of all the things that I just said on the previous page. Their lives were miserable, and someone came to them and said, I am the true Messiah, follow me into the promised land. And honestly, what did they have to lose, right? They were suffering through pogroms and starvation, and life was miserable. So they looked to Messianism. So that's a little bit about, so the end of the story with Shabtai Tzvi is this. He rolls into Turkey, Asia Minor, and under the Ottoman Empire. And the Sultan gets word from his advisors that this crazy guy is stirring up thousands of Jews. He rolls into Constantinople in the mid-1600s, and the Sultan immediately claps him in irons, brings him before a court, and says to him in the palace in Istanbul today, says, you have two choices, death or conversion to Islam. And Tzvi says, I will convert to Islam, right? So they convert him to Islam and put him in prison in Istanbul. Nathan doesn't go to jail, and he goes around all throughout wherever he was going before, continuing to raise money and saying, you might think he's flipped teams, But it's not true. In fact, this is all part of the plan. He's working from the inside now, right? He's converting the Muslims by pretending to convert to Islam, which people actually buy. And he dies in prison 9 years later. Sabbateanism slowly kind of peters out, although there are still Sabbatean Jews in the world. The largest community of Sabbatean Jews in the world is in Istanbul, strangely enough. So, Frankism is all that stuff, except I haven't read as much about it, and there's less sex in eating pork, as far as I know. But Frankism is the same idea, early 1700s, and it's focused around Germany. Jacob Frank, also a quote-unquote false messiah. So those are two little background pieces for what we're about to do. Yeah, go ahead.
Basically, then,
see if we can find a blank
somehow, paper. In all this miserableness,
yep.
You're able to think of things like hope that brought hope to their lives, whether it be the afterlife, whether it be a messiah, whether it be...
Well said. That very much leads us to today. Or not to today, but to the topic that we're going to talk about kind of today, which is Hasidism. Yeah, this was my long-winded necessary segue because I didn't know what you had and had not covered for the last little while. So I'm just giving you the rapid-fire Rabbi Goodman semi-entertaining version. Because I'm interested in the sex and the pork eating. That's really where I'm focused. Okay.
And you're still doing it today.
Wow, I get half a board. This is really just not going my way, is it? Is there a better way to do this?
Yeah, take the back off and flip the whole thing over.
Thank you.
Take the back off and flip the whole
cardboard
thing
off.
Over.
Cardboard off.
Explain. Then I won't have anything. And it doesn't have anything to hang on. That's the problem.
Put it through both.
Oh, you know, I could write on the last cardboard page, too. It's brown, though. All right, fine, we'll write on brown. Or I could hang it upside down, like this. Oh, but then there's nothing hard. Yeah, it's really problematic.
Bend the cardboard down, and then stand it up and write.
Right, exactly.
Bend the cardboard down.
Yes, stand it up as it is now, with the cardboard on the inside.
Yeah.
You got it down. Just stand it up there now.
Yeah.
No.
Don't flip it over.
Don't flip it over. Yeah. It doesn't stand, though. That's the thing. It hangs.
Turn it around.
See, I thought of that.
Wait.
It doesn't sit is the problem.
Well, maybe it can...
Will it sit on the other side?
Not really. Well, I could just kind of thread it through, huh?
Yeah, maybe thread it. That's an idea. It's a little bit too wide.
Yeah, we'll make do.
But it stays. It's not gonna fall.
I don't know why I need this so much. It's just a nice little crutch for me.
Yeah, and then if you can just get it to stay there a little bit.
If I can just get it to stay there.
Oh, there you go.
How about this?
I like when you write.
Put this under like that.
I do too.
There.
All right. We have jury-rigged this whole thing, and now we all need to tell Rodef Shalom to pay for a new flip paper. Okay, good job. Thank you. All right, so today's topic is actually Hasidism. Oh, got it right down here. Hasidism versus Mitnagdim.
And they're still going at it today.
Yes, they are.
So the
Hasidim literally translates as the pious, and they're an evolution of Judaism that is kind of in this line of a response to the misery of the Middle Ages. What was Jewish life like up till here? First of all, we've talked about all the misery for the average Jew. What was Jewish religious life like? It was mostly fixated on obedience to the law, right? Follow the law and everything will go fine. And to Sharon.
Danielle.
Sorry,
my name tag is not in my
To Danielle's point, there was a very strong sense theologically that life would be better for you if you just observe Judaism strictly. Follow the law and God will reward you. The person who is punished by a pogrom or an illness or whatever, it was probably because you violated Jewish law in some way. So strict adherence to Jewish law was the focal point of Judaism up till Hasidism. And as a fairly logical result, Judaism was kind of miserable. It just wasn't particularly enjoyable in this period. So what happened? go ahead.
Didn't it also require that you be very well educated in order to be able to study Torah and read the laws and follow the laws? And
you grew up in the religion, so you know, a lot of you know this. A lot of you know how to keep kosher because your grandmother or your mother kept kosher in the kitchen. If your meat spoon fell in your milk pot, you just went to the rabbi. It just meant that your town had a rabbi, and the rabbi was pestered with questions all day long, right? A rabbi in modern America looks nothing like a rabbi in Europe in this period. My job all day long back in the good old days, 300 years ago, would be to sit in my dusty office and read books all day, and then have men and ladies come to me and ask me questions for that, for me to resolve. In fact, sermons on Shabbat was not a thing. Back in the old days, they gave one sermon a year. It was the Shabbat preceding Pesach. And the sermon was roughly a one-hour excursus on the laws of keeping kosher in your kosher kitchen for Passover, right? That was the one time a rabbi publicly spoke back in the good old days. Now, it evolved over time, and probably in the 1700s, rabbis did speak publicly. But we don't have the concept of the modern sermon at synagogue until Jews come to America, really, in the mid-1800s. That's when rabbis start giving sermons at the pulpit. Back in the day, the rabbi was just a guy. And in fact, also, rabbi back in the day also probably meant that a guy had a day job, right? He might have been a milkman and or a baker, or he might have owned land or something like that. You needed a day job. Only in the modern era do rabbis become so specialized that they don't have to have another day job. So the Hasidim jump off, and the first of our Hasidim is this guy named the Baal Shem Tov. So I want you to scan forward in your text to our first text on the Baal Shem Tov. And it should say Baal Shem Tov, a parable, text 1. Everybody have that? Yes. We know where it is? Can I get a volunteer to read?
205.
205. Can I get a volunteer to read this? Go ahead, Vicky.
I heard a parable from my master, my grandfather of blessed and righteous memory. There was someone who played a fine musical instrument melodiously and with great tenderness. And those who heard him could not contain themselves for all the melodiousness and delight, to the point where they would dance almost to the ceiling, owing to the greatness of the delight and satisfaction and melodiousness. Okay. And anyone who was nearby and who would draw still closer in so as to hear this musical instrument would receive greater delight. It would dance all the more mightily. And during this, there came a deaf man who could not hear at all the sound of the melodious musical instrument, but only saw the impassioned dance of the people. They seemed to him insane. And he told himself, what good does this gladness do? And verily, if he had been wise and knew and understood that the cause was the greatness of the pleasure and the melodious sound of this musical instrument, then he too would have been dancing there.
Great. Take a moment and look at this and think to yourself, what's the moral of the story? What is this parable attempting to convey to us, the reader? Yeah.
That the misery is caused by our unawareness of the deeper truth and of God.
Nice. So that's one way of looking at it, that we are living in misery because we choose to, that we choose not to be ecstatic and joyful. Yeah, Vicky, did you want to say something?
That he is unawakened. He is asleep. A person who is not aware to all of this.
Right. The person who chooses to live with misery is choosing that and is walking through life unaware of the beauty and the splendor of God, specifically. So Eric's point is kind of about of life, and yours is a little bit of God, but they're kind of the same. Yeah, go ahead.
Getting to know this splendor and greatness of God does not require going to study texts. It can be found in the exercise of the body and in
good
exuberance.
Good. So another aspect to this is that Jewish prayer up till this point was fairly rote, right? Mumble, mumble, mumble through the Hebrew, stand still, and get through it as quickly as possible. We've all been to synagogues like that, probably. Or maybe not. Hopefully you haven't. So there was a phase in Judaism for probably hundreds of years in which prayer was meant to be solemn. And accuracy and speed mattered the most, right? It's a fairly common trend in any religion which has rote required prayer on a regular basis, right? Let's just knock this sucker out. I'm remembering when I was in rabbinical school on Purim in synagogues, but also, of course, in rabbinical school, it's a good time to have fun. And do something silly and a parody. And one of my colleagues, I went to conservative rabbinical school. One of my colleagues said, you know, the Reform movement, they have all these wonderful songs. And we don't have really any good songs. So I thought I had a good conservative idea, and I wanted to express it in a form of song. So he sat down with his guitar, and he took it out, and he went, prayer's not supposed to be fun. It takes dedication, discharge your obligation, right? And I'll never forget that. Because it is a perfect description of how Judaism saw prayer in the period before Hasidism, which was prayer is not supposed to be fun, discharge your obligation, right? If you ask many modern Orthodox Jews who are young, you know, about Jewish law, the phrase that they'll use frequently is, are you yotzi? Are you yotze? Have you yatsa? Have you gone out? Is the literal translation of yatsah. But the more figurative or the colloquial usage with halakha is, have you fulfilled the obligation, right? Did you knock out that mitzvah? It's what happens when you see a Chabadnik on the street and they say, did you put on tefillin this morning, right? They don't care whether you, not to pick on Chabad, have a mystical spiritual experience and you see the divine when you strap on tefillin. They're just checking off one of 613 commandments, right? Put it in the checkbox, score that point, move on, right? Fulfill that obligation. And Jewish law often has these little things, right? What are the mitzvot that are incumbent upon a Jew on Purim? What are the mitzvot that are incumbent upon a Jew for Passover, right? Fulfill the obligation, move along. Fulfill the obligation, move along. Judaism had descended in the 1600s into just this. Fulfill the obligation. Say the prayers quickly, mumble them under your breath, go off to your job, right? The Baal Shem Tov, Rabbi Israel, Baal Shem, which literally translates as the master of the good name, or they'd also call him, you'll see it at the bottom, the acronym for Baal Shem Tov is Besht. So sometimes he's referred to as the Besht, said he started to write and tell stories. And in his writing and in his storytelling, he said, God created us to be joyful. God created us because God wants God's creation to experience joy. And so everything in Judaism should be joyful. The doing of mitzvot should be joyful. The doing of prayer should be joyful. And you can't do it joyfully by racing through it. And you can't do it joyfully by mumbling under your breath. You should sing. You should dance. And you should do the mitzvot with great joy. This does not potentially sound like a radical concept, except that it was. It was an absolutely mind-bending concept in the 1730s and 1740s in Eastern Europe and Poland and Ukraine, where this all developed. Nobody was talking about this. And if you went to a synagogue, this makes probably more sense to a lot of us, and people are, you go to one synagogue and it's mumble, 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 stand still, stand still, stand still, and go home, versus you go to another synagogue and people are laughing and clapping and singing and swaying, then there you see that there's a radical difference. Like it's the difference between a high Episcopal service in England 60 years ago versus an evangelical church in America today, right? They're radically different. And they're both prayer experiences of Christianity, but they're not the same prayer experience by any way, shape, or form. That's a thing that the Baal Shem Tov invented. The second thing, which you just read, is this thing about parables, right? Judaism was predominantly, let's learn the law and then study the Talmud and see what it says about the law. Suddenly, the Baal Shem Tov starts telling stories. Now, storytelling is not a unique idea in Judaism. The Midrash was a series of Talmudic-era storytelling from long ago. But these stories are more folk wisdom. These are folk parables. And that kind of leads into, so the concept being, Judaism should be part of your lived experience. It should be something that relates to you on your everyday life, okay? So that gets to two other hallmarks, that kind of leads to two other hallmarks of Hasidism. One is access, right? For a certain period of time, this is a pendulum swing that bounces back and forth throughout Jewish history, there was a sense of the importance of the elites in Judaism. That Talmud study and rigorous intellect was only for yeshiva buchers and rabbis, right? And the rank and file average Jew could not have access to the religion at the same level as the truly intellectual, right? That Judaism was a religion of the head, and the head was only for the smart people. And the dumb people, you ask your rabbi and he'll give you a watered-down version of Judaism that you can live by making sure that you eat matzah, right, at the right time. The Baal Shem Tov said, no, this is bogus. Everyone, God created all of us, everyone should have an equal connection to God and should be able to access it. And I can tell it through folk tales. So a parable like this is a great way of relating the information to the average man, as opposed to making it hidden somewhere in this library in Aramaic in small font, right? The second piece that goes with this, which is about this story, is that it's personal, right? And this is something that hopefully we'll take a look at in our text. I might pull it up at the end because I actually teach a Hasidut class right after this class. I had to get them to move their class back 2 hours so that I could teach you guys. So be thankful to them. But I teach some of the Parsha study that the Hasidim did from the Baal Shem Tov and onward. And it's all meant to be personal. And this is maybe the most important thing that I can impart to you. And I'll come back to the mysticism afterwards. So we have all these stories in Genesis and Exodus, right? This week's Torah portion is about the 10th plague, 8th, 9th, and 10th plague, and the death of the firstborn, and the darkness, and all this stuff. Now, the average Jewish commentator for 1,000, 2,000 years would say, 1,500 years would say, what did the darkness in Egypt look like? How did it manifest itself? What were the difficulties? Why does the text use this phrase for darkness that it says a person could not see their fellow, as opposed to saying it was really, really dark? Like, those are the questions they ask. What was the text meaning in its own situation, in its era, at its time? The Hasidim said, who cares? God gave us the Torah for all time's sake. The question is not what did darkness look like in Egypt then. The question is really, what does darkness mean in my life now? Every single text in the Torah becomes personal and directly related to me right now at all time's sake. So the story of Joseph being thrown in the pit is not about Joseph being thrown in a pit. It's about me being thrown in a pit. The story of Abraham standing up to God at Sodom and Gomorrah is not about Abraham being such a brave Jew thousands of years ago. It's about me and my relationship to God right now. And that works, right? And Hasidism takes off throughout Europe. The Baal Shem Tov has students. His students go to other little... He lived in a town called Medjibuj, which is... I mean, basically everybody will say this about Eastern Europe, but it's basically in Ukraine today, but at the time it was part of the Polish Empire, and of course the Russians would conquer it 200 years later. Someone told me a joke that their grandfather used to say, I lived in the same town in Eastern Europe my whole life, and I lived in three different countries. That the line just kept moving, depending on whether the Russians or the Poles or the Austro-Hungarian Empire conquered you. So Medjibuj is Poland, or Ukraine, depending on who you ask. Kishinev is Moldova, or the Tsar's Russia, or Poland, or the Ukraine, depending on who you ask, and so on. So that's a little bit about how it starts. That's the Baal Shem Tov's beginning point. And as you can imagine, he wasn't entirely well received, right? He had he had a lot of opponents who basically said, your ecstatic joy towards the religion is not authentic to Judaism. We're not supposed to live this way. Another thing was, you're dumbing it down for the people and you're pretending like they have access to the information, but they don't understand it on our level. And that's not okay, right? Giving access to everyone wasn't okay. Making the text personal was considered also oversimplifying. And the last piece that was really controversial is the mystical piece. So Hasidim, less so with the Baal Shem Tov, but later with his followers, although he did it to some degree, there's an esoteric form of Jewish wisdom. We call it Kabbalah. In all religions, it's called mysticism. It's basically the presumption that God has given us hints in our world as to what God's nature is like. The question, the epistemological question, can I know God? What can I know? Is a fundamental question in philosophy, epistemology, right? Many people in the Jewish world before this period would say, you cannot know God, right? God is all-powerful, all-knowing, infinite. We cannot comprehend the divine. And the mystics would say, God has given us a Torah text. It's a divine book. Clearly, the fingerprints of the divine are there, and we can understand God through God's text. If we just look at it, we turn it the right way, we'll see the divine shimmering through. And so they used all sorts of really bizarre and esoteric and complex mystical processes to look at the Torah in a much higher level light to see whether you could kind of know God. There's basically two schools of thought on mysticism. Either you can have a direct experience with God or you cannot. Those are the only options, right? The mystic would say you can, but most mysticism in Judaism was left to the elites. One very famous phrase or thing that was taught by one rabbi about mysticism is, mysticism or Kabbalah was only accessible to men 40 years old who learned the entire Talmud 3 times and had children. Why? I don't know. Seems like just setting a really high bar. Like, I'm only, I don't know, maybe 10% through the entire Talmud, maybe, probably more like 5. So going through it 3 times in my life, not looking good. But that kind of setting the bar really high said it's only for the elites of the elites of the elites. Mm-hmm. The Baal Shem Tov said, no, it's for everybody. And I'm going to reveal secrets of Kabbalah in even these little parables. And so he started to talk about mystical practices that any Jew could do. So one that is mentioned in your book is called Dvekut, which is translates well as cleaving, drawing close to the divine by emulating the divine. Another one was called Hitbodedut. So Hitbodedut was like a kind of self-reflection. So the Hasidim taught this concept of Hitbodedut, which often meant that a person should go and be alone outside in nature and meditate for 1 to 3 hours, ideally in the early morning before the sun comes up. So that you should go into the forest at 3 o'clock in the morning and meditate for 3 hours and then come to morning prayer and then spend another hour putting on your tefillin and saying morning prayer. Right? So this concept of self-reflection, of Hitbodedut, was one way that the Baal Shem Tov would say. Another one was they suggested certain breathing exercises that would bring you to an ecstatic state, right? Not so far off from things that you can learn in doing in yoga, right? You'll see in modern yoga practice, they do all sorts of stuff like that. So all of these ideas were brought by the Baal Shem Tov and his followers that the average Jew can experience the divine in a real and raw way. A last one is Kabbalah, which was the Hasidim were very big on revealing the Sfirot, the 10 mystical aspects of the divine, and relating them on a very relatable level. We'll see in a second, the Nagdim did not like this. Yeah?
How do you define elite at that time? Because, I mean, many people think of elite as those having money.
Yeah.
Those who studied didn't have the money. Basically, the other people
yeah.
kept them going. How would you define elite at that time?
It's a good question. There were elites in the Jewish world who did have money. Not everybody was a landless serf or a minor tradesperson, especially though, but in Eastern Europe, most of them were, right? Eastern Europe was where you went when your life didn't work out somewhere else. So Jews were integral in the, from basically the year 1000 through 1940 in Spain and Italy and France as moneylenders, as translators, as people who worked in the king's court. There were people who were elites in those, that world. In Eastern Europe, there were really very few landed moneyed Jews. Mostly Jews were poor serfs. So when I use the phrase, I'm typically referring to intellectual elites. And over this time period, there began to establish for people who could make a little bit of money, the yeshivot, these institutes of higher study. And the Hasidim and the Mitnagdim are actually going to be big supporters of these places where you can learn and study. And they did. The Hasidim, don't misunderstand me, Hasidim believed in study of Torah, study of Parshanut, study of Talmud, the same things that Jews had been studying for 1,000 years beforehand. They just gave it a different spin, right? They gave it a different twist. Okay, so let's look at the next text up. Is this, you guys have text 2? What do you guys have in between text 1 and text 2? Do you guys have
historical
any?
Background.
Historical background, Dveikut, Tzaddik. The Dveikut I mentioned, I'll give you a quick summary of Tzaddik so we don't get bogged down in it. The Tzaddik is this principle that, which is referred to in Talmud, but also referred to in mystical circles, that there were righteous people in every generation. And most of the Tzaddikim, there's a belief, one belief of many, was that there were 36 righteous individuals in any generation. And they were all hidden. So, by the way, there are similar beliefs about this in both the Calvinist world and the Jehovah's Witness world, where people were elect, right? Special people of special quality have been marked by God, but nobody really knows who they are. There's a lot more of them in those religions. In Judaism, it was believed that everybody can be, is special, but there are 36 who are like righteous in every generation, the tzaddik, who is without blemish, who is absolutely perfect. And we should emulate that way and try and live that way. Those tzaddikim were morally correct, but also intellectually of higher caliber. Yeah, hypothetically.
In Baal Shem Tov's or Hasidim's approach of making Judaism more available to the general population,
yeah,
I hear echoes of Martin Luther.
Yes, and I think the fact that he follows Martin Luther by what, like 200 years? Mm-hmm. No. Mm-hmm. When's Luther?
17th century.
Yeah, so roughly, Baal Shem Tov 1730s became popular. There's definitely overflow, cross-flow. I mean, there's, you know, the rabbis almost never talk about Aristotelian and Socratic thought, but it's like there. I mean, Rambam is clearly talking about it a couple hundred years after the fact. So the rabbis generally say secular non-Jewish wisdom is not to be studied, and then they talk about all the studies they've done in it. So, yeah, well said. All right, let's move on and do this second text. Which is the Maggid of Mezrich, Savata Ribash. Volunteer, who wants to read? Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. The tzaddik flourishes like a palm tree, he grows like a cedar in Lebanon. For behold, there are two types of tzaddikim, and they are both complete tzaddikim. But the difference between them is that the first one is always in communion with the Holy One, blessed be he, and performs the divine service that is expected of him. But he is only a tzaddik for himself and not for his fellow man. Which is to say, his righteousness does not influence others. And he is to be compared with a cedar tree, as our rabbi's blessed memory said, which does not bear fruit. For he is only a tzaddik with respect to himself and does not bear fruit in order to return others to good, increase and multiply tzaddikim in the world. This type works on his own behalf so that his own reward will grow and increase. But keep going?
Yeah, go ahead.
Good. But the second tzaddik is to be compared with a palm tree, which bears fruit, and he flourishes like a palm tree, which is to say he produces good out of evil, i.e. sinner, it causes sinners to repent, and causes good to thrive and spread in the world, and his reward is exponential compared with that of the first aforementioned Sadi. Nevertheless, both of them are complete Sadi King.
Great. So you see here a little bit of reflection of Hasidic philosophy, right? There are righteous people who kind of keep to themselves, introverted Hasidim, introverted Tzaddikim, and the extrovert, the one who spreads their goodness throughout the world. So it's a nice kind of idea. This next text is a really lovely one. So one little bit of background. The dove bearer, the Maggid of Meserich, a Maggid is not a rabbi, a Maggid is like a storyteller, was the Baal Shem Tov's chief disciple. And whereas the Baal Shem Tov mostly told his stories and stayed back and did not write, the Maggid of Meserich received his words, wrote them down, and then told parables all throughout Eastern Europe. The Maggid of Meserich builds up something like 7 very famous students who spread his knowledge all over Eastern Europe. Guys like Rabbi Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, guys like Noam Elimelech of Lizensk. There were like 5 other guys like that. And they traveled all throughout Europe kind of sharing this kind of esoteric knowledge. Let's go to the next one, which is the seer of Lublin, which was one, the Jose of Lublin, who was kind of thought of as a prophet. He has a really lovely text here, which is a really great demonstration of how mysticism was brought to the people. Can I get a volunteer to do text 3 here?
Well, we're looking for it. Text 3?
210.
But that doesn't... Oh, I see. Okay.
Should say Rabbi Yaakov Yitzhak Horowitz, Zot Zikaron, okay. Parshat Miketz. Mm-hmm. That's a mouthful.
Yeah.
Volunteer.
When the human quality of mercy, chesed, is restored, the same effect is produced above, so that God does not favor Israel's enemies, nor love them, nor show them a merry countenance. And so it is with the opposite quality, might, givara, one should only anger and despise evil people. This ensures that there will not be any severe judgment, din, on Israel, God forbid, and that severe judgment will only be visited upon Israel's enemies. And so it is with the attribute of glory, tiferet, that one will not intentionally glorify himself. Rather, he should glorify only the Holy One, blessed be he, so that he will in turn glorify us. This ensures that the enemies of Israel will not have any reason to glorify themselves.
Okay, so I drew you a tree. So there's a principle that if God created man in God's image, that God must look like man physically. But we all know God does not have corporeality, does not have physical attributes. So what can this mean? God has a left and a right, a head and a bottom, but they're sort of metaphorical. We also know that in our lives, we experience moments of great mercy and loving kindness for others, and we also have moments of a feeling of anger, justice, or kind of frustration. Another word for that might be strength or harshness, but justice is another way of saying it, right? I usually use the concept of driving because I grew up in Southern California, so everything relates to driving, right? When someone speeds down your street, cuts you off, and blows through a red light, there are 2 ways of looking at that. One way of looking at it is to say, he broke the law, he cut me off, what an SOB, right? There are rules here, you're endangering lives. Totally legitimate way of approaching the situation. Another way of looking at that situation is to say, maybe he's going to the hospital because his mother is sick. Maybe he's late for work and his boss told him, you come late one more time and you're fired, right? So suddenly I'm looking at this person with eyes of mercy, with eyes of chesed. But God has both attributes. As God gives us both those attributes, clearly God has both those attributes. How do we balance them as human beings? What does the balance look like? The seer of Lublin says that splendor or beauty, tiferet, is when you put these 2 qualities in balance, right? And all of humankind has these, you know, left and right extremes of balance, right? We have our lived experience, right? Our chokhmah, and we have our kind of intellectual experience that's without lived experience. Like there's experience, and then there's kind of wisdom and understanding, which we would call, what did I say, Chochmah and Bina, right? And they're two different kinds of intellect, and God has them both too, right? There's what the book tells you how to do the thing, and then how you actually do the thing, right? They're very different, right? You can't read a teacher's manual and just suddenly become a great teacher. You can't read the manual for your Mazda and drive a car really well. You've got to learn how, when you move to Pittsburgh, for instance, people are going to make left turns as soon as the light turns. That's a thing here, apparently, right? This is the difference between the two. So that's a little bit about what he's talking about here. And that's how the Hasidim brought this concept down. All right, we're going to do one last text. I spent zero time on the Mitnagdim because I'm a terrible person. But also, basically, all you need to know about the Mitnagdim is they hated all of this. They didn't like any of it. They wanted their religion to go back to rigorous, intellectual, and mostly unhappy. Although the unhappiness was an aspect of understanding the understanding what God wanted us, that suffering was part of the human condition, which is laudable, right? The understanding of suffering is an important part of all religions. Sometimes they used good intellectual arguments to maintain discipline. Other times they used rank and outright slander. And it's pretty extreme. So I want you to skip all the way to text 9. I think there's a text 9. Because it's the worst one and it's really short. So someone find it.
David of Makkah?
Yeah, 8's really good because it's interesting because it talks about more the intellectual disagreements between the two schools. But 9 is the salacious, nasty stuff that I know you guys like. So let's have.
You just studied Lashon Hara.
I know. So let's do some. No.
Let's practice it.
But we're actually looking at a text that one of the rabbis of the Mitnagdish group brought about the Hasidim to kind of, and it's not true. Can I get a volunteer?
Very visceral.
who's a little bit interested in ribaldry? There's a fancy word for a Wednesday morning.
I got it.
I'll read the filthy words.
Thank you.
David of Makkah, attack on Hasidim. The Hasidim commit the sin of involuntary ejaculation at all times during their prayer, for they deliberately give themselves erections during prayer, according to the commandment of Israel Baal Shem, the founder of Hasidism, who said to them that just as one who engages in intercourse with an impotent organ cannot give birth, so one should be potent at the time of prayer, and in prayer it is necessary to unite sexually with the Shekhinah, the female emanation of God. It is therefore necessary to move back and forth as in the act of intercourse. So, is this true? No, not at all. One aspect of it is true, though. They were having ecstatic prayer. There was joy, and people were shuckling back and forth. We all know about the shuckling back and forth. But the belief is, by the way, there's a verse in our morning prayer that comes from Psalms. Kol asmotai tomarna. All my limbs shall tremble before you, my God. The person who stands still during prayer is as if they are dead, right? Don't just praise God with your mouth. Praise God by moving. Praise God by dancing and swaying. There's also something that happens, I know this because I have had times in my life where I swayed during prayer, where it brings you to a different state to be moving while you pray than when you're not. So somebody in the Mitnagdish world said they're humping, right? This is just fornicating, and they're fornicating in synagogue and calling it prayer. And it was a slander to get people to not take a look at what's going on. So this was the fight that was going on in this period. Thank you guys. I went over by 4 minutes. I will see you guys. I had to end with the sex, right? You gotta give the people what they want. I will see you guys next week. Thank you.
Thank you.
And you know, when you didn't have to go to the rabbi worrying about kashrut when you had a spoon drop in the dairy sink.
Yeah.
You just buried it in the vacuum.
Right. That didn't work. It was a nice idea.
Did you ever resurrect her?
It's at Beth Shalom. So as long as I get out of here in the next 10 minutes, I can make it on time.
Is it for anyone to
know?
Yeah.
We do text study. Yeah, oh yeah. It's a class called Life in Text. We actually start with a question.
February 10th.
and then we do a tax on it. So it's a nice class. It's about an hour. It's about an hour. The only downside is you got to drive over there.
You can't get them all to come here and just stay here.
Nah, because it's special in class. They're paying me to do class.
So it's like special.
Not at all.
And can I come at any time? Meaning like, yeah, you've already been doing this for a while?
It's, there's no sign up, there's no fee, and we meet at 12:15 every Wednesday. So the only downside is you're going to have to bring a sack lunch. But yeah, it's fun class.
I've also been told the idea is there's either love or fear.
Yeah.
And doesn't this kind of fit into it?
Yes.
So in Chesed, wouldn't this be the love side?
Yes.
And then this would be the fear.
Yep.
But I've never seen something to balance into a middle.
Right.
I was told where there can be love, there can be fear.
Right. So there's intellectual left and right. There's kind of a moral left and right. Down here is two different aspects of beauty. Right. There's Hod is one of them, and Hod over here and Netzach over here. Netzach, I think, is kind of divine beauty, and Hod is kind of perceived beauty. Yeah, you should.
This is Kabbalah.
Yeah, this is called the ten sefirot, and there's no good translation for the sefirot, but aspects of the divine.
What?
I mean, I'm one of the few people who teaches it in town, basically. But there's we do it in a chassid in my class on today. We'll do a little bit of it, but I don't always bring it. There's not just this. There's another. There's the Kabbalists also had a concept of four worlds. At the base level, they thought of called Malkuth, which is kind of God's divine emanation in our world at a higher level. And then at the lowest level, there was Shekhinah, and it's the divine presence in the universe, which was mentioned. Malkuth also has a concept of
fear of committing the Shekhinah.
Sorry.
Too much for me.
I know, I know.
Right now,
I get excited.
I know, but this is what I want to learn about this.
Yeah.
How can we do this? Is there a book? Is there a class that you're willing to teach? Do you have time if I gather people together for it? Or one-on-one?
Yeah, let me know.
One-on-one. Because this is the kind of stuff I'm really interested in.
Sure.
I'm right now reading a book called A Return to Love, and it's all about... Familiar with the Course in Miracles?
Yeah.
You shouldn't be. Anyways, but it's all about God's love for us.
Right.
And this is what I want to learn about.
Well, let me know. Give me some time. But if you wanted to start a class somewhere,
I could try. I can't say that. Okay. That is so.